simple. We would drive down the alley behind Lockwood's house one time with our lights off, our eyes scanning the windows and doors. If we saw the least hint of movement in the house, we would keep driving, head back to Minnesota, and report what we found to Max Rupert. If, however, the night stayed silent and we saw no sign of Lockwood, Lila would park the car behind the neighbor's garage. I would slip out, sneak up the path using my best ninja stealth, and steal the top garbage bag. I unlock my door as we enter the mouth of the alley, Lila's little car struggling against the dips and traps of the snow and ice. We pass behind his neighbor's garage to view the backyard of the Lockwood house, the darkness broken only by a thin light falling from the kitchen window. I strain to see any movement behind the shadows cast by the ambient glow of the neighbor's Christmas lights. We pass the property, and seeing nothing to stop our folly, Lila stopped her car behind the next garage and covered the dome light with her palm. I clicked open my door, slid out, and crept back up the alley to the path Mrs. Lockwood had shoveled between the house and the alley. I paused one last time at the beginning of the path and listened. I heard nothing beyond the slight whistle of wind. I stepped onto Lockwood's property, a thin layer of fresh snow crunching under my feet. My pace remained slow and cautious, as if I were walking a tightrope. 30 feet, 20 feet, 10 feet. I could almost touch it. Suddenly, the blast of a car horn cut through the cold December air about a block away and stopped my heart for a beat or two. I didn't move. I couldn't move. I stood perfectly still, expecting a face to appear at the window. I prepped myself to run back to the car, envisioning a foot race with a murderer, but nobody came. Nobody peeked out. I gathered my wits and took that last step. The lid of the can sat off-kilter on top of the top trash bag. I lifted the lid carefully and laid it in the snow. Enough light filtered from the window above me to see the neck of a garbage bag. I raised it slowly, like a jewel thief avoiding motion sensors, my reflexes sharp, my balance steady, and my eyesight, well, a bit lacking. I didn't see the beer bottle leaning against the top of the bag until it glinted in the thin light as it tumbled from the top of the trash can. It spun end over end, hitting the bottom wooden porch step, bounced, spun some more, and fell to the sidewalk. It smashed into 1,000 tiny bits, announcing my presence with authority. I turned and ran down the walkway, clutching the bag of rubbish with a death grip in my right hand, glass and tin clanking inside the bag like a junkyard wind chime. I reached the junction of the path and alleyway just as the back porch light burst to life. I hit the ice in full stride, my feet shooting out from under me, sending me sprawling across the alley, my hip and elbow exploding in pain from the fall. I stood up and ran the short sprint to the car, the garbage bag held tight in my hand. Lila hit the gas as soon as my ass hit the seat, not even waiting for the door to close. Her tires spun on the ice, and the back end of the car slid back and forth, nearly hitting the nearby garage. A shadowy figure, silhouetted against the floodlight above Lockwood's back door, ran down the walkway toward us. Lila's tires caught a thin strip of gravel, breaking the spin and moving us down the alley and onto the street, leaving the shadow of Dan Lockwood behind us. Neither of us spoke until we passed beyond the city limits. I kept watch behind us, expecting to see the headlights of Lockwood's truck closing in. They never appeared. By the time we reached the interstate and headed north, I had relaxed enough to peek into the garbage bag. There, on the very top, next to an old ketchup bottle and a greasy pizza box, were at least 20 Marlboro cigarette butts. "We got 'em," I said. Chapter 45. We had Lockwood's cigarette butts, his DNA, the last piece of an ever-changing puzzle. The DNA from one of those butts would match the DNA on Crystal Hagen's fingernail. Everything was coming together to prove that Daniel Lockwood, Danny Jr., DJ, was the man who killed Crystal Hagen all those years ago. It all fit. As we drove north on Interstate 35, making for the Iowa-Minnesota border, we remained vigilant, exiting the interstate twice just to make sure no one was following us. We would wait and watch as the headlights passed us. Only then would we merge back onto the interstate. Soon, we crossed into Minnesota, pulling over in Albert Lea to get some gas and food. We switched seats to give Lila a break from driving. As we pulled back onto the interstate, my cell phone rang with the theme from Pirates of the Caribbean, the ringtone I had assigned to Jeremy's number. This was the first time that Jeremy had ever called me, other than when we were practicing. A shiver ran up my back. "Hey, buddy, what's up?" I answered. There was no response. I could hear him breathing on the other end, so I spoke again. "Jeremy, you okay? Maybe do you remember what you told me to do?" Jeremy spoke with more than his normal hesitation. "I remember," I said, my voice dropping into a deep valley. "I told you to call me if anyone tries to hurt you." I felt my hand grow tight around my phone. "Jeremy, what happened?" He did not respond. "Did someone hit you?" I asked. Still no response. "Was it Mom?" Silence. "Did Larry hit you?" I asked.
Maybe Larry hit me. God damn it.
I held the phone away from my mouth as I cursed through clenched teeth. I'll kill that son of a bitch. I took a deep breath and placed the phone back against my ear.
Now listen to me, Jeremy. I want you to go to your room and lock the door. Can you do that for me?
Maybe I can, he said.
Tell me when you've locked the door.
Maybe the door is locked now, he said.
Okay, now take the pillowcases off your pillows and fill them with your clothes. Can you do that for me?
Maybe I can, he said.
I'm on my way there now. You wait in your room until I get there, okay?
Maybe you're coming from the college? He asked.
No, I said. I'm almost there already. I'll be there in no time.
Okay,
he said. Pack your clothes.
Okay.
I'll see you in a bit.
I hung up my phone just in time to catch the interchange from Interstate 35 to Interstate 90. I would be in Austin in 20 minutes. Chapter 46. I skidded to a stop in front of my mother's apartment, throwing Lila's car into park and leaping out the door in a single motion. I covered the 20 feet between the street and the porch in a sprint of 5 steps, bursting through the front door and catching Larry and my mother off guard as they sat on the couch, beers in hand, watching television.
"What did you do to him?" I yelled.
Larry jumped to his feet, throwing his beer can at my face. I swatted it away without breaking stride. He drew his fist up as I shoved my palms into his chest, lifting him off his feet and sending him sprawling over the back of the couch. Mom started screaming at me, but I walked past her and went to Jeremy's room, gently knocking on the door as if I were simply stopping by to wish him good night.
"Jeremy, it's me, Joe," I said.
The lock clicked open. Jeremy stood next to his bed, his left eye a spectrum of red, blue, and black, nearly swollen shut. He had his pillowcases stuffed with his clothes on the bed beside him. Larry was a lucky man to be beyond my reach at that moment.
"Hey, Jeremy," I said, picking up the pillowcases, feeling their heft.
"You done good," I said, handing them back to him.
"You remember Lila, don't you?"
Jeremy nodded.
"She's by your car, in front of the house."
I put my hand on his back, leading him from his bedroom.
"Take these to her. You're coming to live with me."
"The hell he is!"
Mom screeched.
"Go on, Jeremy," I said. "It's okay."
Jeremy walked past my mother without looking at her, moving quickly across the living room and out the door.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Mom said in her best scolding tongue.
"What happened to his eye, Mother?" I said.
That was nothing," she said.
"Your piece of shit boyfriend beat him up. That's not nothing. That's assault."
"Larry just gets frustrated.
Then you should kick Larry out, shouldn't you?" I said.
"Jeremy pushes Larry's buttons."
"Jeremy's autistic," I yelled.
"He doesn't push buttons. He doesn't know how to push buttons."
"Well, what am I supposed to do?" she said.
"You're supposed to protect him. You're supposed to be his mother."
"So I can't have a life? Is that what you're saying?"
"You made your choice," I said.
"You chose Larry, so Jeremy's coming to live with me."
"You're not getting his Social Security money," she hissed.
I shook with rage, clenching my fists, waiting to calm down a little before I spoke again.
"I don't want the money.
He's not a meal ticket. He's your son.
What about your precious college?
Her voice pitched with sarcasm as she spoke. For a brief second, I saw my future plans withering on a vine. I drew in a deep breath and sighed. Well, I said, I guess I made my choice too. I started for the front door, only to find Larry standing in my way, his hands balled up into fists in front of him.
Let's see how tough you are when you're not blindsiding me, he said.
Larry stood sideways in an awkward boxer's stance, with his feet growing roots parallel to one another, his left fist poking out in front of him, his right tucked up against his chest. He couldn't have made himself a better target if he tried. With his left foot planted sideways, he exposed the side of his left knee to attack. The thing about knees is that they're made to bend front to back. If you kick the back of a knee, it will buckle. If you kick the front of a knee, it will remain strong. But the side of the knee is a whole different story. Knees are as fragile as dried twigs from the side. Okay, Larry, I said, smiling. Let's have a go. I walked at him as though I were going to charge face first into the right hook he had planned for me. But I stopped short, turned, cocked my leg back, and drove the heel of my foot into the side of his knee as hard as I could. I heard the bone crack, and Larry screamed as he fell into a heap on the floor. I turned, looked at my mother one last time, and then walked out the door. Chapter 47. I leaned my forehead against the passenger window of Lila's car, staring off beyond the lights of the gas stations and towns we drove by. I could see my future dissolving, melting away, my vision blurred by the speed of the car, by the drops of water on the window, and by the tears that were starting to well up in my eyes. I would never go back to Austin, Minnesota. I would be responsible for Jeremy from now on. What had I done? I whispered the words out loud that had been banging on the doors of my brain since I'd left my mom's apartment. I can't go to school next semester. I can't take care of Jeremy and also go to school. I wiped my eyes before turning back toward Lila. I'll have to get a serious job. Lila reached across to my seat, rubbing the back of my still-clenched fist until I let it fall open so she could hold my hand. It may not be that bad, she said. I can help take care of Jeremy. Jeremy's not your responsibility. It was my decision. He's not my responsibility, she said, but he is my friend. She turned and looked at Jeremy, who'd curled up and fallen asleep in the back seat, his cell phone still grasped in his hands. Look at him. Lila nodded toward Jeremy. He's sleeping so soundly. It's like he's been awake for days. He knows he's safe now. You should feel good about that. You're a good brother. I smiled at Lila, kissed the back of her hand, and turned toward the window to watch the miles go by and think. It was then that I remembered something my grandfather once told me, something he'd said the day he died while we were eating sandwiches on the river, something I had blocked out of my memory for all these years. You're Jeremy's big brother, he'd said. It's your job to take care of him. There's going to come a day when I won't be here to help out, and Jeremy's going to need you. Promise me that you'll take care of him. I was 11. I didn't know what my grandfather was talking about, but he knew. Somehow he knew that this day would come. And with that thought, a caress of serenity untied the knots in my shoulders. As we neared the apartment, the shift from interstate highway to city streets changed the musical tone of the tires, causing Jeremy to stir. He sat up, unsure at first of where he was, looking around at the unfamiliar buildings, his brow furrowed, his eyes blinking hard. We're almost home, buddy, I said. He cast his eyes down to think. We're going to my apartment, remember? Oh, yeah, he said, a slight smile building on his face. We'll get you tucked into bed in a couple minutes, and you can go back to sleep. His eyes furrowed again. Maybe I need a toothbrush. You didn't bring your toothbrush? I said. To be fair, Lila said, you didn't tell him he was moving. You just said to pack his clothes. I rubbed my temples where a slight headache was starting to build. Lila pulled the car over to the curb in front of the apartment. Can you go one night without brushing your teeth?
I asked. Jeremy started rubbing his thumb across his knuckles and gritting his teeth, causing the muscles beside his jaw to pop like a frog's gullet.
"Maybe I need a toothbrush," he said again.
"Calm down, buddy," I said. "We'll figure something out." Lila spoke again in her soft, calming voice.
"Jeremy, how about if I take you up to Joe's apartment and get you situated, and Joe can go get you a new toothbrush? Will that be okay?"
Jeremy stopped rubbing his hands. The emergency abated.
"Okay," he said.
"Is that okay, Joe?"
Lila smiled at me. I smiled back.
There was a small corner store about 8 blocks away. Just one more detour and a long day of detours.
I liked how Lila talked to Jeremy, her soothing demeanor, her genuine affection for him. And I liked how Jeremy returned those feelings, or at least his version of those feelings, almost as though he had a crush on Lila, an emotion I knew to be beyond Jeremy's palate. It made me feel a little better about all that had happened. I was no longer Joe Talbert the college student, or Joe the bouncer, or even Joe the runaway. I would, from that day forward, be Joe Talbert, Jeremy's big brother. My life would be defined by the chain of small emergencies in my brother's world, like this forgotten toothbrush. Lila took Jeremy upstairs to help him prepare for bed, and I hopped behind the wheel to go buy a toothbrush. I found one at the first convenience store I went to. The toothbrush was green, the same color as Jeremy's old toothbrush, which was the same color as every toothbrush Jeremy had ever owned. If I hadn't found a green toothbrush at that store, I would have had to find another store. I bought some additional supplies, paid for everything, and headed back to the apartment. My apartment was quiet and dark when I got back, the only light being a small bulb over the kitchen sink. I could hear Jeremy sleeping in the bedroom, his muffled snore signaling that his anxiety over the lost toothbrush had given way to his exhaustion. I placed the toothbrush on the bedside table and backed out of the room, letting him sleep. I decided that I would sneak next door to give Lila a kiss goodnight. I knocked lightly on her door, a single knuckle tap, and waited. No answer. I raised my hand to knock again, paused, and then let my hand fall. It had been a long day. She'd earned a good night's sleep. I returned to my apartment and sat down on my couch. On the coffee table in front of me, I spied Max Rupert's card, the one with his personal cell number on it. I picked it up and contemplated calling him. The clock was about to strike midnight. Surely, the evidence Lila and I had gathered, the bombshell information about the real DJ, was important enough to warrant the late-night call. I put my thumb on the first button to call Rupert, then backed off, deciding instead to get Lila's opinion. Besides, that would give me the perfect excuse to go to her apartment and wake her up. I took Rupert's card and my phone and headed next door. As I was about to knock, my phone rang, causing me to jump. I looked at the number. A 515 area code. Iowa. I lifted the phone to my ear.
"Hello?"
"You have something of mine," a low, raspy voice whispered.
"Jesus, it couldn't be. Who is this?" I said.
"Don't play games with me, Joe."
The voice barked the words. He was pissed.
"You know who this is."
"DJ?" I said.
I tapped on Lila's door, holding the phone to my cheek so that he couldn't hear my tapping.
"I prefer to be called Dan," he said.
Then it hit me.
"How do you know my name?" I asked. "I know your name because your little girlfriend here told me."
Waves of hot and cold panic convulsed in my chest. I turned the doorknob. Lila's door was unlocked. I pushed it open to find her kitchen table tipped on its side, her books scattered, her homework papers strewn across the linoleum floor. I struggled to make sense of what I saw.
"Like I said, Joe, you have something of mine."
Dan paused as if to lick his lips.
"And I have something of yours."
Chapter 48.
"Here's what's going to happen, Joe,"
Dan said.
"You're going to get into your car and drive north on I-35, and make sure you bring that bag of trash you stole from me."
I turned and ran down the steps as fast as my feet could carry me, my cell phone still pressed tight against my ear.
"If you hurt Lila, I'll..." "You'll what, Joe?"
he said.
"Tell me, I really want to know. What are you going to do to me, Joe?"
But before you tell me, I want you to hear something.
I heard a muffled voice, a woman. I couldn't make out her words. It was more of a grunting sound. Then the grunting sounds gave way to a voice.
Joe! Joe! I'm sorry!
She tried to say more, but the words dropped behind a wall as if he'd put a gag into her mouth.
So tell me now, Joe. What?
If you hurt her, I swear to God, I'll kill you,
I said as I jumped behind the wheel of Lila's car.
Oh, Joe.
There was a pause, then a muffled scream.
Did you hear that, Joe?
He said.
I just punched your pretty little girlfriend in the face, very hard. You interrupted me. You made me punch her. If you interrupt me again, if you do not follow my instructions to the smallest detail, if you do anything to try and attract the attention of a cop, your little Lila here will suffer the consequences. Have I made myself clear?
You've made yourself clear, I said. A sickness welled up in my throat as I started Lila's car.
That's good, he said. I don't want to hurt her anymore. You see, Joe, she didn't want to give me your name or your phone number. I had to persuade her that it was in her best interest. She's a tough little bitch.
My knees felt weak and my stomach queasy at the thought of what he was doing to Lila. I felt utterly helpless. How'd you find us?
I don't know why I asked him that question.
It didn't matter how he'd found us. Maybe I just wanted to keep his attention on me, talking to me. If he was busy with me, he wouldn't be hurting her.
You found me, Joe, remember?
He said.
So you probably know I run security in a mall. I know the cops. I got the license plate number off her car when you went through my alley. That brought me to little Miss Lila here, and she brought me to you. Or should I say, she's bringing you to me.
I'm on my way, I said, again trying to turn his attention back to me. I'm turning onto I-35, like you said.
To make sure you don't do something stupid like call the police, you and I are going to talk as you drive. And I can't stress this enough, Joe. If you hang up, if you go through a dead zone, if your battery dies, if anything happens to disconnect us, well, let's just say you'll need to find a new girlfriend.
I sped down the on-ramp, one hand on the wheel, the other holding the phone to my ear, the car screaming as it ran through its gears. A tractor-trailer hogged the lane, so I floored the accelerator. The truck seemed to speed up, as if the driver were trying to assert some misplaced testosterone-fed dominance. I gripped the wheel so tightly my fingers ached. My merge lane grew thinner as I raced toward an oncoming viaduct rail, the truck's tires whining next to me, inches from my window. My lane turned into a shoulder as my car inched past the front bumper of the truck. I jerked onto the interstate, my back bumper narrowly missing his front bumper, his horn blaring his displeasure.
I hope you're driving carefully, Joe, Dan said. You don't want to get pulled over. That would be tragic.
He was right. I couldn't allow myself to get pulled over. What was I thinking? I slowed down to match the speed of the other drivers, blending in as just another set of headlights. Where am I going? I said, once my pulse returned to a manageable pace.
You remember where my old man's house is, don't you?
I shuddered with the thought.
I remember.
Go there, he said.
I thought it burned down, I said.
So you heard about that? Terrible thing,
he said, his voice flat, uninterested, as if I was an annoying child interrupting his morning read. I began looking around the car for a weapon, a tool, a scrap of anything that I could use to wound him or kill him. Nothing lay within reach except a plastic windshield scraper. I flicked on the dome light and looked again. Fast food trash, some spare winter gloves, papers from one of Lila's classes, Dan's bag of garbage, but no weapon. I heard bottles clinking in the garbage bag when I was running from Lockwood's house. If nothing else, I could grab one of those. Then I saw a glint of reflection in the back seat, something silver, half tucked in the crack where the seatbelt and cushion met.
You seem quiet, Joe,
Dan said.
I'm not boring you, am I?
No, I'm not bored, just thinking, I said.
You're a thinking man, are you, Joe?
I hit the speakerphone button and laid the cell on the console between the two front seats, turning up the volume.
I don't make it a habit, but it happens every now and again, I said. I quietly pulled the lever, allowing my seat to recline as far as it would go.
Tell me, Joe, what's on your mind?
I was just remembering my visit with your dad. He seemed a little out of sorts when we parted. I slid back in my seat, holding the steering wheel with the tips of my fingers, waiting for a straight section of highway. How's he doing? I asked the question partly to hear his reaction, and partly to get him talking as my straight section of highway appeared.
I guess you could say he's seen better days,
Dan said, his tone shifting cold. I let go of the steering wheel, flopped back on my seat, and grabbed for the shiny metallic object in the back seat. I got one finger around one side and a knuckle on the other side and pulled. My fingers slipped off. I reset my grip and pulled again. Jeremy's cell phone slid out from between the cushions, spinning forward, stopping on the front edge of the seat.
Of course, Dan went on, it's like they say. You shouldn't send an old drunk to do a man's job.
I sat up to find the car drifting off the road, heading toward the shoulder. I grabbed the wheel, correcting with a slight squeal of the tires. Had there been a cop anywhere in the area, I would have been pulled over. I watched the rearview mirror for Cherries. I watched, waited. Nothing. I breathed.
But he meant well,
Dan finished. He meant well? By trying to kill me? I said, trying to keep him talking. I pulled the seat lever, allowing the seat back to shoot into the upright position.
Oh, Joe, Dan said. You're not getting naive on me, are you?
I reached back, picked up Jeremy's cell phone, and turned it on.
Was it his idea to kill me? I said. Or was that yours?
I arched my back, reaching into my pocket to pull out Max Rupert's card.
The bottle to your head, that was his idea,
Dan said. I put my finger on the first digit of Rupert's personal cell number, held the phone against my leg to silence the tone, and pressed the button.
Imagine my surprise, he continued, when he called me to tell me what you found in Crystal's diary.
I continued pressing numbers.
After all this time, you figured it out,
he said.
You really are a thinker, aren't you, Joe?
I checked the number one last time and hit send, holding the phone to my ear, praying that Rupert would answer.
Hello?
Rupert's voice came through. I clapped my thumb over the phone's speaker so that Dan Lockwood wouldn't hear Rupert, but Rupert would hear my conversation with Dan.
I'm not as smart as you think, I said, holding Jeremy's phone near my phone. All this time I thought DJ stood for Douglas Joseph Lockwood. You can imagine my surprise today when your wife told me that you were DJ. I was shocked. I mean, your name is Daniel William Lockwood. Who would think that anyone would call you DJ?
I tried to be obvious with my words to clue Rupert in on my plight without cluing Dan in on my plan. I had to trust that Rupert was listening and understanding what was going on, that this call in the middle of the night was more than a misdialed number. I needed to engage Dan Lockwood and force him to tell his secret. Chapter 49. In the minutes that I spent driving north to face Dan Lockwood, an errant thought had been lurking in the shadows of my mind. Mercurial, unformed, hiding behind my fear. I sensed its presence, but paid it no heed while I scrambled to come up with a plan to save Lila. Now that I had Rupert on the phone, and hopefully listening to my conversation with Dan Lockwood, I calmed down and gave voice to that errant thought, allowing it to grow in clarity and volume until it screamed, Dan Lockwood had no choice but to kill us. Why had I been panicking? I knew what lay ahead. He would bring me to him, and then he would kill us both. He couldn't let us live, not with what we knew. I felt a strange solace wash over me. I knew his plan, and he needed to know that I knew. Dan, you ever play Texas Hold'em? I asked.
I'll bite, he said. Sure, I've been in a tournament or two.
There's that moment when you have your two cards, and I have my two cards, and the dealer throws down the flop.
Yeah. And?
And I go all in. I lay down my cards, and you lay down yours. I know what you have, and you know what I have. And now we just wait for the dealer to play it out, to see who wins. No secrets.
Go on.
Well, I'm going all in, I said. I'm not sure I follow, Dan said. What's going to happen when I get out to your dad's place? I said. Surely you've thought this through.
I have an idea or two, he said. The better question is, have you thought it through?
You're bringing me out there to kill me. You're using Lila to make sure I come. And after you kill me, you'll kill Lila. I took a breath. How am I doing?
And yet you're still on your way.
Why? The way I see it, I said, I have two options. I can run to the police, give them the DNA, tell them you killed your sister.
Stepsister.
Stepsister, I repeated.
In which case, he said, poor little Lila here dies tonight.
His voice grew cold again.
And what is your second option?
I took another deep breath.
I can come out there and kill you, I said.
There was silence on the other end of the phone. You see, I said, I'm still on my way because you have Lila. If she's not alive when I get there, I have no reason to stop, do I? You'll have another murder on your hands, but I'll have you. The cops will hunt you to the ends of the earth. Lila will be avenged. You'll die in prison, and I'll piss on your grave.
So you're going to kill me, are you?
He said. Isn't that what you're planning to do to Lila and me? He paused. And then what? I said. Dump us in a river, or burn us in a shed?
A barn, he said.
Ah, that's right. You're the firebug. You torched your dad's place too, didn't you? He went silent again. I'm betting you also killed the old man to save your ass.
I'm gonna enjoy killing you, Dan said. I'm gonna do it so damn slow.
Your old man cleaned up your mess by going after me, but in the process he made himself the perfect scapegoat. He tells you about the DNA, about the diary, about the evidence that led me to him instead of you. It's perfect. So you kill him, hide his body where no one will ever find him, and burn his house down to keep the police from testing his DNA. I gotta hand it to you, Dan. That was clever. Fucking twisted, but clever.
Oh, it gets better, Dan said. When they find your body in this barn, near his house.
He waited for me to connect the dots. They'll blame him, I finished. That is, unless I kill you first.
I guess we'll see in about 10 minutes,
he said. 10 minutes?
I know how long it takes to get here. If you're not here in 10 minutes, I'll assume you made a colossal mistake and tried to bring a cop to our little party.
Don't worry, I said. I'm coming. And if I don't see Lila standing on her feet and alive when I drive up, I'll assume that you made a colossal mistake. I'll drive on by, and I'll bring the world down on you.
Then we understand each other, he said.
Chapter 50. With a 10-minute limit to drive a 5-minute distance, I was ahead of schedule. I tried to think of what else I could do to prepare. I had been driving with my thumb over the speaker of Jeremy's cell phone, keeping Rupert's voice away from Lockwood's ear. As the county road twisted through some frozen wetlands, I eased back on the throttle, giving Rupert every possible second to catch up. Had I given him enough clues? Dan and I talked about his father's house, the one he burned down, and a barn nearby. Rupert knew where the house was. He's the one who told me about the fire. He was a cop, a detective. He would figure it out. I carefully lifted Jeremy's phone, removed my thumb, pressed the speaker tightly to my ear, and listened. No voice, no breath. No white noise of a car engine in the background. Nothing. I looked at the face of the phone, at Rupert's number backlit on the screen. I listened again. Silence. I cupped my hand around the mouthpiece, whispering Rupert into my hand in a soft breath, enunciating the consonants, spitting them out so that Max might understand me and answer. He didn't answer. I stopped breathing. My hand trembled. Had I been leaving a voice message this whole time?
Rupert,
I whispered again. Still no answer.
I dropped Jeremy's phone onto the floor behind the passenger seat, my mouth suddenly dry. I had no plan now. No way of saving Lila. I could smell Lockwood's garbage, his DNA, the evidence of his crime decaying behind my seat. If I had been recording on Rupert's voicemail, then Rupert would get the message and know that Dan Lockwood killed us. I decided to drop the trash in the ditch. If things went bad, Rupert might find it and use it to nail Lockwood. As a backup plan, it sucked, but it was all I had. I reached behind my seat, easing the bag up and onto my lap, the cans and bottles rustling slightly as it settled. I felt the neck of a beer bottle pushing against the side of the bag. Using my fingernail to tear a hole in the side of the bag, I eased the bottle out and set it next to me on the seat.
5 minutes, Joe,
Dan called over the speaker on my cell phone. Let me hear Lila's voice.
You don't trust me?
What's it matter to you? I said, with more than an edge of frustration, or maybe resignation, in my voice. Consider it a final wish. I heard Lila mumbling as Dan removed the gag. The phone would be away from his ear, giving me an opportunity to pitch the bag. I slowed the car to a crawl to limit the wind noise, lowered the window, and steering with my knees, slid the garbage bag out, giving it a toss so that it landed in the snow-covered ditch. Joe? Lila murmured. Lila, are you okay?
That's enough chit-chat, Dan said. You have 2 minutes. I don't think you're going to make it.
I closed my window, picked up my speed again, and crested the last rise before my turn onto the gravel road where Doug Lockwood once lived.
If you're at your old man's place, then you can see my headlights.
I flicked the brights on and off a few times.
Ah, at last, the hero approaches, Dan said. There's a tractor path just past my dad's place. It leads to a barn. That's where I'll be waiting.
With Lila standing where I can see her, I said.
But of course,
he said smugly.
I'm looking forward to meeting you.
I turned onto the gravel road, my eyes searching the darkness for movement. The chimney of Doug Lockwood's house was a lone spire rising from a pile of ashes. Spurs of ice left behind by the fire hoses dangled from its edges like frozen plumage. I drove past the house and paused before turning into the tractor path. I followed the tire tracks laid down in the snow by Dan Lockwood's four-wheel drive pickup. The trail wound back 80 feet to a dilapidated gray barn, the planks of its walls rotting and separating like old horse teeth. I knew that I would get stuck in the snow before I got anywhere near the barn. I clicked the high beams on and gunned the engine, ramming Lila's little car into the snow. A wall of white exploded high into the air, the crystalline flakes shimmering in the glow of the headlights. I plowed along for 10 feet before I ground to a halt, the tires spinning impotently, the engine revving in futility. I took my foot off the accelerator and watched as the final mist of powdery snow drifted away in the breeze. A single, heavy, insistent thought filled my mind.
Now what?
Chapter 51. My headlights fell across the snow-covered pasture, illuminating the barn in the distance. Lila stood in front of the tattered door, her arms stretched above her head, her hands tied together by a rope that reached up to a hoist outside of the hayloft. She appeared weak, but she stood under her own power. Dan Lockwood stood next to her, a gun in one hand, pointed at her head, a cell phone in his other hand. 70 feet of snow-covered field separated me from the barn. The field between us was bordered by a tree line about 50 feet to my left and a creek off to my right. Both the tree line and the creek extended from the road back beyond the barn. Both could provide cover. But the creek might get me within 30 feet of Lockwood. I lowered the car window, grabbed my phone and the beer bottle, and slid out the window. No creaking door hinge to announce my intention. Putting the phone against my cheek to hide the light of the display, I moved around the back of the car, heading for the creek.
I think you should bring my garbage to me, Dan said.
I needed to stall. I'm afraid I can't, I said, as I sidestepped my way into the creek. The headlight shining in Dan's eyes covered my movement in the shadows.
The snow's too deep. Getting tired of fucking around here, he yelled.
The ice crackled under my feet as I moved closer to the barn. I paused for a moment to peek over the creek bank to see Dan still focused on the car. A thin surface of ice had crusted over the snow, making a light popping noise with every step, barking my arrival into the quiet night. I moved faster when Dan spoke, hoping that the noise of his own voice in his head would cover my approach.
"Get out of your fucking car and walk your ass down here," he yelled into the phone.
"I think you should come here and get it," I said.
"Do you think that you have any say here, you little cockweasel?"
He put the gun to Lila's head.
"I hold the cards. I'm in control."
I turned my walk into a scamper as he yelled, my head lowered, the phone still tight to my ear.
"You get your ass here or I'll kill her right now."
I was close enough now that he might hear my voice coming from the creek instead of the phone. I lowered my volume to a whisper, the change in tone giving my words a menacing edge that I had not expected.
"You kill her, and I'm gone. The cavalry will be on your ass before the echo dies."
"Fine," he said. "I won't kill her."
He lowered the muzzle of his gun to her knee.
"If you're not in my sight in 3 seconds, I'll take out her pretty knees, one at a time. You have any idea how painful a bullet in the kneecap can be?"
I had gone as far as I could in the creek.
"After that," he said, "I'll start on other body parts."
If I charged, I'd be dead as soon as I came into the glare of the headlights. If I stayed in the creek, he would dissect Lila with his gun. From this distance, I would hear her screams of pain through the gag in her mouth.
"One."
I looked around for a better weapon than the beer bottle, a rock or stick, anything.
"Two."
A fallen tree jutted out from the opposite shore, its dead branches within reach. I dropped the bottle and grabbed a branch as big around as a stair rail and jerked it with all my weight and strength. It snapped off with a deafening crack. I stumbled back. Two shots rang out from Dan's gun, one hitting a cottonwood tree above me, the other bullet disappearing into the darkness. I grunted as if I had been shot and threw my cell phone like a frisbee onto the frozen surface of the snow on the far bank of the creek, its display casting a beam of light that could be seen from the barn. I crept up the near bank, hiding behind the cottonwood with my stick. I waited for Dan's approach, hoping that his attention would be focused on the light from my cell phone on the opposite bank.
"You're a persistent fuck," Dan called out. "I'll give you that."
I raised my stick, gauging his distance by his voice, listening to his footsteps draw closer. He stopped walking just out of reach of my stick, probably letting his eyes adjust to the darkness away from the headlights. "Two more steps," I thought to myself. "Just two more steps."
"It's not gonna work, Joe,"
he said, taking another step toward the creek, his gun still pointed toward my phone, his voice lowered, almost whispering in my ear.
"I hold the cards, remember?"
He stepped again. I lunged from my hiding place behind the tree, swinging my stick at his head. He pulled his gun around, raising it at me as he ducked away from my swing. My aim failed. The stick crushed into his right shoulder instead of his skull. But his aim failed as well, the gun firing a bullet into my thigh instead of my chest, the hot lead tearing through the skin and muscle, punching into the bone, turning my leg into useless weight. I fell face first into the knee-deep snow. Chapter 52. If I stopped my attack, I would die. Lila would die. I pushed my body up with my arms, only to crash back into the snow, the full weight of Dan Lockwood driving down on my back. Before I could react, he pulled my right arm behind my back, a cold metal handcuff ratcheting around my wrist. Why hadn't he shot me in the head? Why keep me alive? I fought to keep the other arm away from him, but his weight on my shoulder blade and neck brought my struggle to an end. He stood up, grabbed my collar, and dragged me through the snow, leaning me up against a fence post at the edge of the barn. His belt made a zipping sound as he pulled it from his pants. He wrapped it around my throat, buckling me to the fence post. Then he stood back, admired his handiwork, and kicked me in the face with his snow-covered boot.
"Because of you, my dad is dead," he said. "You hear me?
This was none of your damn business. Fuck you. I spit blood from my mouth. You killed your dad because you're fucking insane. You raped and killed your sister because you're fucking insane. See a theme? He kicked me in the face with his other foot.
Bet you're wondering why I didn't just shoot you, he said.
It crossed my mind. I mumbled. I could feel a tooth rolling around in my mouth. I spit again.
You're gonna watch me, he smiled. I'm gonna rape the shit out of your little girlfriend here, and you're gonna watch. You're gonna hear her scream and beg just like they all do.
I lifted my head, my eyes blurry, my ears still ringing from his kicks.
Oh yes, Joe, he said. There have been others.
He walked over to Lila and lifted her chin in his hands. I could see a patchwork of red and purple bruises crossing both her cheeks. She looked weak. He slid his hand down her neck, grasping the zipper of her sweatshirt between his fingers, and pulling it down. I fought against the belt around my neck, pulling at the thick leather, trying to stretch it or break it or pull the post out of the ground. Nothing budged.
You can't get away, Joe. Don't hurt yourself.
He put his hand on her breast, and she came to life as if waking from a trance. She tried to wiggle away from his touch, her tether making resistance impossible. She tried to kick him with her knee, but she was too weak to have any effect. He punched her hard in the gut for her effort, emptying her lungs of air. Lila gulped and wheezed, trying to breathe.
In a few minutes it'll all be over, and you'll be burned up in a blaze of glory.
He wet his lips, drawing in close to Lila, reaching one of his hands down to undo the buckle of Lila's pants, while moving his gun up her body, brushing the muzzle over the contour of her torso, pausing at her breast for a second. He slid it up her throat, then her cheek, before raising it to her temple. He started to lean in as though he might lick her face or bite her, but he stopped, interrupted by the difficulty he was having undoing her belt with a single hand. He took a step back to get a better look at the buckle. When he did, the nose of the gun tipped skyward for just a second, away from Lila's head. Suddenly, three quick gunshots erupted from the tree line. The first bullet entered Dan Lockwood's left ear, exiting the right side of his head in a spray of blood, bone, and brains. The second bullet ripped through his throat with similar results. Lockwood was dead before the third bullet cracked through the plate in the side of his skull. He fell to the ground, a lump of meat and tissue. Max Rupert stepped from the shadows of the tree line, his gun still pointed at the pile of waste that used to be Dan Lockwood. He walked over and kicked the body onto its back, Lockwood's eyes staring blankly up at the sky. Two more figures stepped from the shadows, sheriff's deputies, each wearing brown winter coats with badges on the left lapel. One spoke into a radio microphone pinned to his shoulder, and the horizon lit up red and blue, as if the officer had called in his own personal Aurora Borealis. Soon, the lights of the squad cars crested the rise, their sirens piercing the night. Chapter 53.
The shootout at the barn made the news and started the snowball rolling. The press wanted to know why a man from Iowa took three bullets in the head and why two local college kids were at the scene. In order to justify the shooting and clear Max Rupert of any wrongdoing, the city scrambled to put flesh on the bones of what Lila and I had discovered. Within 24 hours, not only had they reopened Crystal Hoggins' murder case, but they'd moved it to the head of the line. By the time they issued their first press release the following morning, they had confirmed Lila's deciphering of the code and that Dan Lockwood had been called DJ by Crystal and other family members back in 1980. On the second day after the shooting, the Minnesota BCA verified that the DNA found under Crystal Hoggins' fingernail belonged to Dan Lockwood. Not only that, but when the BCA ran Lockwood's DNA profile through CODIS, the national DNA database, they got a hit. Lockwood's DNA matched the profile in a case from Davenport, Iowa, where a young girl had been raped and killed, her body found in the rubble of a burned-out barn. The city held a press conference to declare that Dan Lockwood had likely killed Crystal Hagen in 1980, and that he had been on the verge of killing one or both of the college students when Detective Rupert had fatally shot him. The city and the press united in their praise of Max Rupert, holding him up as a hero for killing Lockwood and saving the lives of the unidentified University of Minnesota students, who likely would have been his next victims. One reporter learned my name, and that I had been at the scene when Rupert shot Lockwood. She called my hospital room to ask me some questions, referring to me as a hero and buttering me up real good. I didn't feel like a hero, though. I had nearly gotten Lila killed. I told the reporter that I didn't want to talk to her, and that she should not call me again. My professors all granted me extensions for my final exams and term papers. I took them up on their offers, all that is, except for my biography class. Lila brought my laptop to the hospital, and I spent hour after hour propped up in my bed typing. Lila also brought Jeremy to the hospital to see me every day. She had spent a couple hours in the emergency room that night, getting checked over by the doctors before being released with bruises on her face and torso and abrasions on her wrists where the rope had cut into them. She'd slept on the couch in my apartment after that, with Jeremy sleeping in the next room. The doctors kept me in the hospital for 4 days, releasing me 2 weeks before Christmas with a bottle of pain medication and a pair of crutches. By the time they discharged me, I had written twice as many pages as were required for my biography of Carl Iverson. I had completed the project with the exception of the final chapter, Carl's official exoneration. On the morning they discharged me, Professor Sandin met me in the hospital lobby. He seemed winded as he crossed the room to greet me, smiling like he had just won a raffle. "Merry Christmas," he said. Then he handed me a document. A court order with a raised seal on the bottom. My pulse quickened as I started reading the formal language of the heading. State of Minnesota, Plaintiff versus Carl Albert Iverson, Defendant. I continued reading the document line by line until Professor Sandin interrupted me by flipping to the final page and pointing to a paragraph that read, "It is hereby ordered that the conviction of Carl Albert Iverson for the crime of murder in the first degree, found by verdict dated January 15, 1981, and entered as judgment on that same day, be hereby vacated in its entirety, and that the civil rights of said defendant be fully restored effective immediately upon the signing of this order." The order was signed by a district court judge and dated that very morning. "I can't believe it," I said. "How did you..." "It's amazing what you can get done when the political will is there," Professor Sandin said. "With the story about the shooting making national news, the county attorney was more than happy to expedite things."
"So does this mean..."
"Carl Iverson is completely and officially innocent," Sandin said, beaming with delight. I called Virgil Gray and invited him to join us when we went to visit Carl that day. Janet and Mrs. Lorngren also came with us to Carl's room. I thought about framing the order, but decided against it, as that didn't seem the kind of thing that Carl would have wanted. Instead, I simply handed him the document, explaining what it meant, explaining that in the eyes of the world it was now official. He did not kill Crystal Hagen. Carl rubbed his fingers across the raised seal on the bottom of the first page, closed his eyes, and smiled a melancholy smile. A tear trickled down his cheek, which caused Janet and Mrs. Lorngren to start crying, which made Lila, Virgil, and me tear up, too. Only Jeremy remained dry-eyed, but that's Jeremy. Carl struggled to reach his hand out to me, and I took his in mine and held it.
"Thank you," he whispered. "Thank you, all."
We stayed with Carl until he could no longer keep his weak eyes open. We wished him a Merry Christmas and promised to come back the next day, but that didn't happen. He died that night. Mrs. Lorngren said that it was as though he simply decided that the time had come for him to stop living. His death was as peaceful as any she had ever seen. Chapter 54. Not counting the minister, 13 mourners attended Carl Iverson's funeral. Virgil Gray, Lila, Jeremy, me, Professor Sandin, Max Rupert, Janet, Mrs. Lorngren, two other staff members from Hillview, and three guards from Stillwater Prison, who remembered him fondly from his time there. He was buried at Fort Snelling National Cemetery,
laid to rest in formation next to hundreds of other Vietnam veterans. The minister kept the graveside ceremony short, in part because he had never met Carl Iverson and had little to say about him beyond the standard text, and in part because a cold December breeze swept unfettered across the broad, open expanse of the cemetery. After the service, Max Rupert left with Bodie Sandin, but not before insisting that Lila and I meet them later at a nearby restaurant for coffee. I could tell that they had something they wanted to talk about, something that apparently required a modicum of privacy. I went to say goodbye to Virgil, who had been carrying a paper sack with him for the entirety of the service, clutching it to his chest. Once we were alone, he opened the bag and pulled out a display case. An oak box about the size of a dictionary with a glass face. Inside, pinned to red felt backing, were Carl's medals. Two purple hearts and the silver star. Below the medals were arm patches signifying that Carl had been promoted to corporal before his discharge from the army.
"He wanted me to give these to you," Virgil said.
I couldn't speak. For at least a minute, all I could do was stare at them, at the way their polished edges glistened, the way the silver and purple popped against the blood-red background.
"Where did you find these?" I finally said.
"After Carl got arrested, I snuck into his house and took them."
Virgil shrugged, as if I might fault him for the theft.
"Carl didn't have much in the way of possessions, and I figured that one day he'd want these back." "They are..."
Virgil pursed his lips to hold in his sobs.
"Were his only possessions."
Virgil held out his hand, and I shook it. And he pulled me in and gave me a hug.
"You did good," he whispered. "Thank you."
I thanked Virgil, and then turned to make my way to the car, where Jeremy and Lila waited. Virgil remained at the gravesite, apparently not ready to leave his friend. At the restaurant, Lila and I were warming our hands in our coffee mugs when Max and Bodie arrived. Jeremy sipped hot chocolate from his mug, slurping to draw it out from under a layer of marshmallow. I introduced Max and Bodie to Jeremy. Jeremy said a polite hello, as he had been taught, then turned his attention back to his hot chocolate. I gave a brief explanation of how Jeremy came to live with me, leaving out the part where I broke Larry's knee.
"That's going to make school a little more difficult," Bodie said.
I dropped my gaze to the table. "I won't be going back to school." It was the first time I'd spoken those words aloud, even to myself. Though I had officially dropped all my spring semester classes, saying it out loud made it all the more real. When I looked up, I saw Bodie and Max exchanging a glance and, to my surprise, a smile.
"I want to show you something," Max said, retrieving a piece of folded paper from his jacket pocket and handing it to me.
I opened it to find an email that had been sent to Max from the sheriff from Scott County, Iowa.
"I've looked into the reward for solving Melissa Burns's murder. It was posted back in 1992 and is still available. It appears certain that Lockwood killed her. He worked as head of security for the mall here in Davenport and must have abducted Melissa as she was leaving the mall. Melissa was the granddaughter of a bank owner in this area, and he put up the $100,000 reward. If you give me a bank account for Mr. Talbert and Ms. Nash, I can have the bank wire it up once our case is officially closed."
I stopped reading, my head nearly ready to explode by the last part.
$100,000? I said louder than I'd intended. "Are you kidding?"
Bodie smiled and said, "Keep reading." "I am aware that Mr. Lockwood is being looked at for two other abductions and murders, one in Coralville, Iowa, and one outside of Des Moines. It is the same modus operandi, and is likely the work of Lockwood as well. I've been informed that there are $10,000 rewards on each of those cases. You should let your people know that they will be entitled to that money if those cases clear."
I handed the email to Lila. I heard her gasp when she read about the money, and then read her name. When she finished, she looked up and said, "Is this for real?"
"Absolutely," Max said. "It goes to you two."
I tried to speak, but could do little more than swallow a lump of air. When I finally managed to speak, I said, "That's a lot of money."
"It's more than you normally see for a reward, I'll grant you that," Max said. "But it's not out of the ballpark, especially for the death of a banker's granddaughter.
If Lockwood was the perp in all three cases, you'll be looking at $120,000.
Lila looked at me. I want you to have the reward, she said. All of it. You needed to take care of Jeremy.
Absolutely not, I said. You almost died.
I don't need it like you do, she said. I want you to have it.
We split it equally, I said. Or I'm not taking any of it. That's not open for discussion.
Lila opened her mouth to argue, paused, and said, We split it three ways.
She nodded at Jeremy.
Without him, we would never have solved the code. He gets a third.
I started to refuse, but she held up a hand, looked me in the eye with the seriousness of a woman who would not be moved, and said, That's not open for discussion. I looked at Jeremy, grinning at me with a marshmallow mustache. He hadn't been listening to the conversation. I smiled back at him, and then I leaned in and kissed Lila. A heavy snow began to fall outside, and by the time we left the restaurant, Lila's car had been covered by an inch of it. She and Jeremy climbed in, while I stayed outside to clean the snow off the windows. I could not stop smiling. With that money, I could go to school and take care of Jeremy. An incredible sense of lightness filled me as I brushed the snow off the windshield. A young couple entered the restaurant, releasing a wave of warm air fused with the scent of fresh-baked goods. The aroma sailed on a light breeze and swirled around my head. It caused me to pause and remember something Carl had told me, that heaven could be here on earth. I scooped snow into my bare hand and watched as it melted in my palm. I felt its coldness against my warm skin and studied the crystalline flakes as they changed into water droplets that trickled down my wrist, evaporating into another existence. I closed my eyes and listened to the music of the breeze as it hummed through the nearby pine trees, punctuated by the chirp of some chickadees hidden in the needles. I drew in a breath of crisp December air and stood perfectly still, savoring the feel, the sound, and the smell of the world around me. Sensations that would have passed by me unnoticed had I never met Carl Iverson. This concludes The Life We Bury by Alan Eskins. Narrated by Zach Villa. Copyright 2014 by Alan Eskins. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Seventh Street Books, an imprint of Prometheus Books, and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.